Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to lunch on this, the second day of the Outlook Conference. And my name is Glenn Davidson. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here to the Grand Buffet Hall in Union House here at the University of Melbourne. This building, you may be interested to know, was built by Robert Menzies, then the president of the Student Union in 1916, and it's been extended subsequently. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to the university the Leader of the Opposition, Tony Abbott. It's a compliment that Mr. Abbott hopes to escape eventually, but most people would say for the last 3 years he has been an outstanding Leader of the Opposition in Australia. And perhaps today we can expect a typically combative speech from him in that role. But before he steps up, I'd like to highlight another side of Tony Abbott, and that's Tony Abbott, the bipartisan opposition leader. And I reflected on this earlier in the week, listening to Mr. Abbott addressing Parliament about Afghanistan, on which he sided with the government on the need to continue Australia's military commitment. It was a very impressive speech. Tony Abbott praised the sacrifice and professionalism of Australian troops. He thanked the Prime Minister for her efforts on behalf of the Australian government to protect them, and he praised previous governments and present government for maintaining the commitment to Afghanistan and defending Australian overseas military commitment, while making it clear that victory on the battlefield is unlikely. Each village, he said, that is no longer subject to extortion, each child whose horizons have been lifted, each girl now able to go to school in Afghanistan and make her own life, constitutes a kind of victory. Mr. Abbott ended that speech using a powerful synthetic biblical metaphor about the lion and the lamb to express the view held by many Australians on the need to maintain strong defence forces. One day, he said, the lion might lie down with the lamb and swords might be beaten into ploughshares, but until that day comes, we would be unwise not to maintain armed forces fit to intervene wherever Australia's interests and values are at stake. It was a striking example of bipartisan support for a national policy. And I think it's a hazard for anyone who takes on party leadership in our democracy that credit is seldom given for efforts that cross the usual and expected lines of party political debate. And yet, our democracy expects the Leader of the Opposition to oppose. And when Mr. Abbott speaks, he leaves little doubt in most people's minds about where he's coming from. Ladies and gentlemen, we are very fortunate to have the Leader of the Opposition with us today for a luncheon address. And after he's spoken, there'll be time for a few questions, which Paul Kelly, Editor-in-Chief of The Australian, will mediate from this podium. Without further ado then, would you please make welcome the Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Tony Abbott.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much. I really appreciate that introduction, but most of all, I appreciate the fact that someone as busy as you has a chance to notice what opposition leaders say in parliamentary statements, particularly parliamentary statements where there isn't likely to be a vast gulf between the positions of the government and the opposition. Before I begin, I wish to acknowledge my parliamentary colleagues, Andrew Robb, Bruce Bilson, Tony Smith, Senator Scott Ryan, Paul Fletcher, Kelly O'Dwyer, Josh Frydenberg and Steve Chobo. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your support in the Parliament, but I particularly appreciate you taking the time and the trouble to come to support this event. I'm not surprised that so many of my parliamentary colleagues have come today because while this is an academic or semi-academic conference. It is about the things that really matter for Australia's future, and I know we politicians don't always get credit for being interested in ideas rather than power. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an important and timely conference because it's not about who is or who isn't winning the short-term political battle, but about who has a plan for the long-term future of our country. My read of the public's mood right now is that they're sick of the spin that's coming out of Canberra. As MPs, we can't opt out of this government's political diversions, but the Coalition's focus will always be on what matters for the forgotten families and the vulnerable small businesses of Australia. That's why good policy should prevail over clever politics, reform over rancour and substance over spin. Get the policy right, Paul Keating used to say, and the politics will look after themselves. I'm not sure how the former Prime Minister would have handled today's 24/7 news cycle, but long-term policy considerations must always be factored into short-term political management if our country is to be well governed. Over the past 2 years, the Coalition has consulted widely across all parts of Australia to develop comprehensive policies to improve our nation. In 5 speeches earlier this year, I developed our plans for a stronger economy, stronger communities, a cleaner environment, stronger borders and modern infrastructure. I thank all my senior colleagues for their contribution to this work, especially the Coalition's economic team, Joe Hockey and Andrew Robb. Due to their hard work, the Coalition has an overall plan for a strong and prosperous Australia and a safe and secure country. As I have learnt from my 9 years as a Howard Government Minister and from my 6 years as Leader of the House of Representatives, good government can foster change for the better. I'm confident that the next Coalition government can build on the strengths of its predecessor, which, after all, delivered more than 2 million new jobs, a 20% plus increase in real wages, and a doubling of Australians' net wealth per head. Ladies and gentlemen, our country is crying out for leadership. Our best days are ahead of us. The backflips and betrayals of minority government are an aberration rather than the new normal of public life. So at the heart of good government is sound economic management. Policy should be directed towards lower and simpler tax, fairer and more effective administration, better and more efficient services, and above all else, towards a stronger and more prosperous economy. With a strong economy, the country can be defended, the vulnerable can be protected, and the environment can be improved. A strong economy provides the conditions where Australians can run their own lives and plan their futures with confidence. The stronger the economy, the fewer the invidious choices that governments have to make. But credible government must have a sound economic strategy. It need not embody a consensus, but it must have a strong rationale consistently pursued. Sound budget management means a sustainable surplus over the medium term, because governments have to live within their means. Sound economic policy needs a productivity focus, because that's the only sustainable way to lift Australian standard of living. The current government, I regret to say, has no credible plan to return to surplus. Deep down, it thinks that the state isn't subject to the same budgetary constraints that apply to businesses and households. Governments can defy economic gravity in a way that families and businesses can't, but not forever. As the Eurozone is discovering the hard way, there are limits even to sovereign government's ability to live beyond their means. Now, 4 days before the last election, the Prime Minister was asked whether she'd resign if she failed to get the budget back to surplus, as promised in the current financial year. "The budget is coming back to surplus," she declared. "No ifs, no buts, it will happen." A day later, the Treasurer declared that the budget would be in surplus by 2012-13, come hell or high water. In fact, Treasurer Swan has declared that the government will deliver a surplus this financial year on at least 150 separate occasions since May 2010. On the return to surplus, Prime Minister Gillard told a community forum just before polling day that failure is not an option because, as she has variously said, A surplus is the right thing to do for Australian families. It's the right strategy for jobs and growth, and the best way we can lock in confidence about the future and send a message to the world. In fact, the message from last week's MyEFO mini-budget is that this government will never deliver an honest surplus. The great disappearing surplus rests on $5 billion of national broadband network spending being kept off budget and $10 billion of accounting fiddles and money shuffles, such as spending just $1 million from the Energy Security Fund this year, but $1 billion in both the year before and the year after. Even with these tricks, the $1.1 billion surplus depends on $2 billion in mining tax revenue. It's lucky that the government chose to deliver its mini-budget on Monday, because on the Thursday, it was revealed that the mining tax had raised no revenue whatsoever in its first quarter. Even from a government that had previously built school halls for no pupils, it takes a special genius to create a tax with no revenue. What's more, next year's supposed $2.3 billion surplus rests on $5.5 billion of brought forward company tax. This paperwork creating fiddle is the best the government can manage to turn an election year deficit into another bodgied up surplus. The government has a political strategy to proclaim a surplus, but not an economic strategy actually to deliver one. Then there are its unfunded future commitments. A further $10.5 billion a year for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, up to $6.5 billion a year for the Gonski education changes, and just last Friday, another $1.7 billion for Murray-Darling Basin infrastructure from a government that's much better at spending money than getting results. Many of these are worthy projects, but they should only be promised when they can be paid for. By mortgaging the future, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer are acting like bad tenants, trashing the house before they're evicted. With a softer Chinese economy, America stagnant, and Europe mired in recession, more than ever, Australia needs to get its own economic house in order. Businesses and individuals borrowing too much and living beyond their means were the root cause of the global financial crisis. In trying to deal with its aftermath, governments don't seem to have grasped that you can't solve a problem caused by too much debt and deficit with yet more debt and deficit. To the extent that they have any validity, the current government's boasts about how well we're doing owe almost everything to the lucky break of the biggest commodity price boom since the gold rush of the 1850s. Yet in 2004-05, with unemployment at about 5%, the Howard government delivered a 1.5% of GDP surplus, despite terms of trade 40% lower than last year, when the current government delivered a deficit of 3% of GDP. That's an instructive comparison. Today's success, such as it is, has been made in China, not here. A sustainable economic strategy can't be based on constantly rising terms of trade. A lazy government has been relying on luck that can't last. Despite the best terms of trade ever, it's turned consistent 1% of GDP surpluses into the four biggest deficits in our history. It's turned $70 billion of net Commonwealth assets into almost $150 billion of net debt, or nearly $7,000 for every man, woman and child. And it's now spending about $20 million a day just to pay the interest on what it's already borrowed. Under the current government, the participation rate has dropped. The pace of jobs growth has been 30% slower, and less than half of the new jobs have been market sector jobs, compared with 70% under the Howard government. Under Labor, GDP per head has grown by just over 0.5% per year, compared to well over 2% a year under its predecessor. Calendar 2011 was the first year in two decades with no increase in the number of jobs. Although the public may be only dimly aware of these details, the massive rise in the savings rate to levels not seen for 20 years, in part, is their implicit vote of no confidence in the current government. People know that these are uncertain times and sense that they should save because the government refuses to. The carbon tax, which the government is desperate to have the coalition stop talking about, is not just a hit on families' cost of living. It's actually emblematic of this government's failure to understand what makes an economy work. It's a great big new tax, great big new bureaucracies, a great big new slush fund, and great big new handouts to politically favoured constituencies. The carbon tax is not a reform in the tradition of cutting tariffs and floating the dollar, because, as Professor Richard Blandy recently noted, these reforms allowed the Australian economy to restructure towards areas of comparative advantage. By contrast, the carbon tax denies our economy the comparative advantage of access to abundant fossil fuel. On the government's own modelling, abolishing the carbon tax alone will add nearly $5,000 to annual gross national income per head by 2050. Abolishing the carbon tax alone will add $1 trillion a year, $1 trillion extra, or nearly a full year's output to our cumulative GDP by 2050. So, the first big economic reform of the next coalition government will be to abolish unnecessary taxes. The carbon tax will go because it damages the economy without helping the environment. And the mining tax will go because it's damaged confidence and investment without actually raising any revenue. Our next reform will be restoring prudent budget management. We'll get spending down by reducing the size of government through natural attrition, rationalising the overlap between different levels of government, and establishing a once-in-a-generation commission of audit to make government more efficient. The abolition of two taxes, slated to raise more than $40 billion over the forward estimates, makes serious savings mandatory, even though the coalition won't go ahead with all the associated spending. That's why I've warned shadow ministers that some of our own initiatives might have to be phased in or commence later than if the current structural budget position were not so poor. In many portfolio areas, the policy the coalition takes to the next election won't involve any new spending at all, but will focus on administrative changes to make people's lives easier. The main elements of the coalition's economic plan are lower taxes, lower spending, closer engagement with Asia, and crucially, higher productivity. Because as Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens has said, everything comes back to productivity. It always does. For the coalition, a more productive economy is a less regulated one. For Labor, by contrast, a more productive economy is invariably one with more government spending, even though it's much easier to spend the money than to get a result. Today, ladies and gentlemen, I release the coalition's deregulation discussion paper arising from the red tape review that Senator Arthur Sinodinos chaired with the help of Kelly O'Dwyer and Senator David Bushby. It's abundantly clear from their consultations that overregulation is an incentive destroying, job jeopardising, family budget consuming burden on our economy and on everyone employed in it. According to the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, 73% of businesses believe that the overall regulatory compliance burden has increased in the past 2 years, and 60% of businesses spend more than $5,000 a year just meeting regulatory requirements. Red tape is feeding into poor multi-factor productivity, which the ABS says fell 4.2% in the 4 years to June last year. In August, the Economist Intelligence Unit ranked Australia as the second worst of 51 countries for productivity growth, ahead only of Botswana. For instance, the now suspended Olympic Dam project required an environmental impact statement running to 29 chapters and 51 appendices that took 3 years to prepare. Applicants for the government's paid parental leave scheme have to read 30 pages of instruction and complete a 48-page form, like a tax return, only without the benefit of a group certificate. This is typical of the extent to which people's business and personal lives now involve ticking boxes rather than getting things done. Under the coalition, every significant government agency and department will be required to quantify the costs that their reporting and compliance regimes impose. Every agency and department will be given an annual target for red tape cost reductions, cumulatively at least $1 billion a year, that will have to be met if senior public service bonuses are to be paid. Under a coalition government, every cabinet submission will once more contain a regulation impact statement that quantifies the compliance costs imposed and contains matching compliance cost cuts. Every year, there will be a deregulation report tabled in the Parliament, and two sitting days will be dedicated to the repeal of redundant legislation and the review of regulations. To ensure that deregulation is taken seriously, I will take responsibility for deregulation out of the Department of Finance and into the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet so that it will have a whole-of-government focus. Now, if the people running businesses have more time for innovation because they spend less time on paperwork, productivity will go up. That's why the deregulation measures announced today are such an important productivity boost. If workers spend less time in traffic jams, they will have more time at work and more time with their families. That's why our commitments to get WestConnex built in Sydney, the East-West Link in Melbourne, and the Gateway Extension in Brisbane, as well as to duplicate the Pacific Highway well within this decade, and to fund infrastructure on the basis of published cost-benefit analyses, are further important boosts to productivity. If businesses, large and small, are competing on a genuinely level playing field, where the most cost-effective products dominate markets, regardless of who supplies them, our productivity will go up. That's why our root and branch review of competition laws is another important productivity initiative. If the public schools and public hospitals that comprise more than 5% of our total economy are more responsive and efficient, productivity will improve. That's why community-controlled public hospitals and independent public schools, where individuals have a stake in the institution and a say at the board table, are also a productivity measure. If more women are in the workforce, our economy will be more productive. This means addressing the impediments to greater employment for women with families. We need a better childcare system that's less geared to 8 to 6 institutional care. And we need a fair income paid parental leave scheme that gives women a better chance to combine families and careers. Australia is one of only two countries where parental leave isn't based on people's actual wage. If people receive their actual wage while sick or on holiday, they should also receive their actual wage while on parental leave. Parental leave, after all, is supposed to be a workplace entitlement, not a welfare one. Ladies and gentlemen, strategies to improve participation must also include people currently on welfare. The best form of welfare is work. That's why more work for the dole for unemployed people and more rigorous analysis of disability pension claims to try to keep people attached to the workforce are also good for productivity. If there are fewer strikes and if unions are better governed, our economy will be more productive. That's why restoring the Australian Building and Construction Commission, ensuring that union officials and company officials face similar duties, accountabilities and penalties, and addressing the militancy, flexibility and productivity problems arising from the Fair Work Act are also part of our productivity agenda. But from day one, the next coalition government will be as concerned to create wealth as to redistribute it. To restore confidence, people will need to know from day one that Australia is under new management. That's why I'm announcing today a Productivity Priorities Working Group to be chaired by Steve Chobo, with Josh Frydenberg and Dan Tehan as deputies, to consult with business and community stakeholders on the implementation of our productivity agenda so that it can effectively be implemented from day one. Now, ladies and gentlemen, because no one owns the Liberal or the National parties, the next coalition government will govern in the national interests, not in the interests of any particular section of the community. We understand, though, in a way that the current government palpably does not, that you can't have strong communities without strong economies to sustain them, and you can't have strong economies without profitable private businesses. I will end the bad blood between government and business that is damaging investment and employment and that sapping the confidence that's so important for every Australian's prosperity. We will do government differently. We will talk to people before we make decisions, rather than just recriminate about them afterwards. Today I announce that if elected, the Coalition will establish a new Prime Minister's Business Advisory Council to meet three times a year. It'll be chaired by Mr. Maurice Newman, the former head of the Australian Stock Exchange and Deutsche Bank, and will include representatives from the manufacturing, agricultural, services and knowledge sectors, as well as from the resources sector, because we will need a strong five-pillar economy when the mining boom is over. Not everything that's good for business is good for Australia, but what's bad for business is very rarely good for our country. That's why this council is important and will have its first meeting within 6 weeks of the swearing-in of a new government. Ladies and gentlemen, my colleagues and I understand that governing this country is an honour that political parties and politicians have to earn. That's why we are presenting a real economic strategy with a real understanding of business and a real commitment to helping every Australian worker to be as productive as possible, in addition to doing the standard opposition job of holding the current government to account. Australia is blessed with a benign climate, an abundance of natural resources, and people who respect each other and want to work together productively to make our country strong. We are a great people who know that we could make more of ourselves under a better government. My colleagues and I are waiting for a chance to make a difference, and we hope it comes soon enough because Australia certainly needs a change. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much again for being here. Thank you, Glenn, and your team for extending this invitation to me. This has been a very important series of conferences run by Melbourne University in conjunction with the Australian newspaper. As a university man, I applaud you, and as a former journalist for the Australian, I applaud my old paper as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Abbott. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a pretty tight timetable. We can take three or four questions, so can I ask people to indicate who they are and where they're coming from. Tom.
Mr. Abbott, Tom Dusevic from The Australian. Your theme today was deregulation and productivity, so how come you're opposed to deregulation of the wheat industry?
Well, Tom, I'm not opposed to deregulation of the wheat industry. I think it should be the right deregulation in the right way, and I'm not confident that that was what the industry was going to get from the current government. Nevertheless, as they say, as Paul Keating, in fact, used to say, the dogs bark, but the caravan moves on, and I think that caravan has now moved on.
Next question here.
Thank you. I'm Tony Scott, University of Melbourne. Healthcare is going to be one of the biggest pressures on the public budget in coming years. What's your magic bullet?
Well, there is no magic bullet, but better healthcare is actually a productivity measure. I can remember as health minister being very forcefully reminded by my distinguished colleagues in central agencies that the health budget was going up and up and up, and it was going up and up and up, but it has been going up and up and up for a long time. In fact, if you look at the Australian health budget or the Australian health sector generally in 1960, it consumed less than 5% of GDP. When I left the health portfolio in 2007, health was almost 10% of GDP. Now, on the face of it, that looks pretty economically problematic. But between 1960 and 2007, Australians' real wealth had quadrupled at least. And one of the important factors in the quadrupling of our wealth was the fact that people were living not just longer, but more productively. If people aren't dying of cancer or heart attacks in their 40s and 50s, they live much more productive lives. So provided health spending passes rigorous cost effectiveness evaluations, and most federal government health spending does pass that kind of evaluation. To get onto the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, there is rigorous testing by the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee, a very well-regarded body with a strong health economics orientation. To get onto the Medicare benefits schedule, again, there's a cost-effectiveness test, perhaps less rigorous, but nevertheless real. So I think provided health spending does pass those kinds of tests, we shouldn't be concerned that it's increasing because the benefits will be worth it.
Judith.
That the government has tried to prosecute. We're now adding, admittedly, a considerable extra sweetener at the end, but by and large, the parameters are those of your the Howard government. So are you proposing to object to the plan or see if you can play a kind of constructive role?
Well, Judith, the general rule for oppositions is that you support good proposals, you oppose bad proposals, and if you can make imperfect proposals better, you normally try. Now, we haven't seen a final proposal from the government. We look forward to seeing that proposal. I think there's a lot of political wedging being attempted by the government, and I want to reassure people that the coalition will not be wedged on this issue. But look, our position is that we support a good plan. We always have, we always will. We put the whole thing into being back in early 2007 when John Howard was Prime Minister and Malcolm Turnbull was the very well-regarded Water Minister. We want to maximise the amount of water that goes back into the environment, provided we don't significantly prejudice the economic base of the Murray-Darling Basin. Now, that's going to be a question of judgment, to some extent a question of fact. We'll carefully analyse what the government puts forward and then we'll make our position clear.
And we can take a final question.
Over there, Paul.
Over there, yes.
If you were to go on and win, say, five terms, mm-hmm. and become one of the most successful prime ministers ever...
Sam, is this a fantasy or is this a prediction?
I thought you'd enjoy it. So what sort of Australia would you like to look back on? How would you like to have changed the country? What great legacy would you like to look back on and say, I'm really proud of what I did?
Well, Sam, thanks. You know... I am mistrustful of top-down visions imposed by government. What I rejoice in are the visions that individuals have and communities have and organisations have that they can then set about realising for themselves. So, essentially, my vision is for a people who are freer, prouder and more prosperous, and the end of government is to try to bring that about. That's why lower taxes, smaller government, greater freedom is the liberal part of my soul. Respect for families and values that have stood the test of time is the conservative part of my soul. And running a very practical, can this be achieved, ruler over everything is the pragmatic part of my soul. And the coalition at its best should always be an enlightened blend of liberalism, conservatism and pragmatism.
I call on Glyn Davis to move the vote of thanks.
Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, we've heard a fascinating opportunity to hear from Tony Abbott and hear him reflect as well as respond to your questions, and that is the enduring value of this conference, a chance to discuss firsthand the subjects that matter. So will you please join me in thanking the Leader of the Opposition, Tony Abbott, and Editor-in-Chief, Kelly. And thank you, Mr. Abbott, and your colleagues for joining us for the 2012 Economic and Social Outlook Conference.